Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast of We've Got Mail here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I contribute to Slash Film. And for the purposes of this particular podcast, if you wish...
Say the words.
Yeah, you can call me Rockmeister McCool.
Dude, I wish I was Rockmeister McCool. That's a much cooler name.
But, you know, I don't know.
You don't know?
I just call me Whitney.
That would be like turning down, like, Nitro. Like, oh, hey, Nitro, please.
Oh,
call me Pancakes.
Okay, William, have you seen me?
Yes.
Am I a Nitro to you?
Nicknames aren't necessarily directly related. Like, sometimes it is, like, hey, Stretch, if you're, like, really tall. Like, that's a common one. But sometimes they have to do, like, one weird incident that no one was there for.
Yeah.
Like... hey, why did they call you Toothpicks? Oh, one time I fell on a bunch of toothpicks and they stabbed me and I had to get them all surgically removed. That has nothing to do with... You had no reason to know that, you know? It's not a great name, actually. It reminds me of some painful times. Anyway,
this is where we read your letters.
This is where we read your letters here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. How it works is you send us correspondence and gosh dang it, we read it. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter or postcard, whatever you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, at 90064.
Yes.
Yes.
We didn't go to the P.O. Box this week.
No, we didn't, but we have plenty of emails.
There was we had a problem with the post office. It's fine. We'll deal with it next time.
Yeah.
We apologize if there's something in our mailbox. We will get it.
It's being taken care of.
It was a problem with the post office, not our fault. We're going to move on. But we have a lot of emails, and we really want to read them. So, Whitney, take it away.
Here is a letter from The Windy.
Oh, hello.
With an I, Windy. I-N.
Two I's?
With two I's.
Okay.
Hello, Bibbium and Whitmeister. That's us.
I can dig it.
I just wanted to respond to your praise of the CIA listenership on the last Letters episode.
Oh.
I wholeheartedly agree that with you... that we are comprised of all kinds of interesting people with tastes and opinions all over the cinematic spectrum. But you are the ones curating this fan base. The amount of obscure, independent, and international movies you have introduced me to is vast. From listening to your podcast, I found any number of amazing movies that were now among my very favorites. I promise I didn't choose a letter.
I was about to say,
Whitney,
come on. Thank you for the letter.
Also, you're so handsome. No,
oh,
While we are patting ourselves on the back for naming films like Werkmeister Harmonies, you go ahead and pat yourselves right back because I learned about this very movie from you guys in the first place. Keep up the great work and best wishes from across the big water, The Windy.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you.
Very, very nice of you.
William just patted himself on the back.
Well, I will say this, and I don't want to take too much time on this one because it's a compliment, and I don't think that's the spirit of the thing. Not that compliments aren't the spirit of the thing, it's just I don't want to go on for 10 minutes. That is what we want to do. So that's a really big compliment,
actually. That's kind of a critic's job, is to...
Yeah.
One of a critic's main jobs is to try to highlight the things that would go unnoticed otherwise.
Yeah, and a lot of people try to do that in the present day, you know, make sure you see this little movie that came out, or this movie's very underrated, and that's great, too, but I think we should be doing it throughout all of history as much as humanly possible. So, thank you, and we try. So, that's really cool. I'm really, really glad that we've helped a little. That's nice. So.
And watch Werkmeister Harmonies.
You should.
That's a good movie.
Yes. And also Merry Melodies.
That's a Werkmeister Harmonies, Merry Melodies.
I mean, that's a good double feature.
It took me an embarrassing amount of time to realize that the character of Merry Melody on Tiny Toon Adventures was named after the Merry Melodies.
Which one was Merry Melody?
She was barely in it. She had, like, cameos.
I was about to say. Was she a duck?
She was, like, a human girl who was just there sometimes.
I do like, not remember her at all.
Here's the Merry Men, and there's Merry Melody, and she would have a line like, oh, another cameo, another paycheck. But she wasn't played by a celebrity.
Uh-huh.
She was played, like, Cree Summer was also there to sort of voice this character.
Okay.
Yeah. Not that Cree Summer isn't a celebrity.
That's Cree Summer, but it's like, it's not what you usually think of as a cameo. Cree Summer would just be in the show normally.
I think she also played Sweetie on that show, so, like, she was around.
Yeah. It's like saying French Stewart cameoed on Third Rock from the Sun. No, you're just in that.
He's just a star of the show.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
It also took me a long time to put together that there was Montana Max,
who's
like the boy version of Yosemite Sam. I put that together.
Yes.
Elmira, however, seemed like an original creation.
She's Elmer Fudd.
Well, Elmira and her last name is Duff, which is Fudd backwards.
Yeah.
I didn't put that together until I was, like, in my
30s. Oh, yeah, no, she's literally...
Elmira.
Also Elmer backwards. Elmer wants to shoot animals. She wants to hug them and kiss them and squeeze them and call them George.
Yeah.
You know, Okay.
I thought she was great.
I mean, she is great.
Yeah. But I didn't... I didn't think she was the distaff counterpart of Elmer Fudd.
Listen, normally I'm the one who takes 20 years to get there, so it's just kind of nice to know that it happens to other people.
Yeah, I was 12, I was just taking it at face value. I wasn't, like, putting the connections together.
Yeah. All right, well, we should move on.
Here's another letter. This one comes from Michael. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hello, Sir Wilsby McBibsy and Maestro Rockmeister McCule. And there's little flourishes and filigrees on the letter.
I love it.
Ever since I started my new job, I have not had a ton of time for podcast, as I listen to them at my old job to help me kill time. But since my new employment, I make sure to carve out some time for you two whenever I get the chance.
Aww, well, thank you
for doing that. Because seriously, you two actually saved my life about 3 years ago when I was going through a dark time. I was unemployed and going through a horrendous breakup, so thank you for the nonstop podcast and giving me some sort of schedule to follow. Anyway, we're not here to have a pity party. We're here to discuss business.
Oh, uh-oh.
Well,
I don't like business.
Thanks for listening, and I'm glad we could help you through that.
It's incredibly just warms my heart to know that we helped in any way.
Yeah.
And although I will say this, I think this is the first time who ever told us we were on schedule.
we're hardly really ever on schedule, but
But seriously though, that means a lot.
Thank you so much. And know that we're people too. We've been there, and we can relate to all of that.
Art has specifically saved my life. I've talked about this before. An episode of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Literally saved my life. Yeah, so I'm with you. Yeah. And the fact that we could help at all, and I don't want to, you know, thank you for saying it, but, you know, you're the one who did the work, and I'm very proud of you.
Anyway, after that heart-rending opening, we're going to get into Disney movies, so hang on. During your review of Lilo and Stitch, you two discussed people's favorite Disney movies, and I forgot who, but someone said that no one is a Home on the Range kid or a Chicken Little kid.
Yeah.
I would like to say on the record that I was both.
What?
I had the Home on the Range DVD and the Chicken Little DVD that I would watch on repeat. As of writing this email, I have no idea where these DVDs are, as I think they were thrown out by my parents.
Oh, I hate it when they do that.
You're the one.
But no,
you're the kid who watched Home on the Range.
There can be only one. Like a bunch of Disney kids fighting with their DVDs, like the Glaive from Krull, but it's Highlander. It's like, oh no, we killed the Make Mine Music kid.
He was the last one. Home on the Range, I'm not going to lie, I cannot tell you the plot of that movie if you put a gun to my head, but I vividly remember a minecart sequence with cows in them, so I'll constitute that as me being a Home on the Range kid, because I don't see anyone else coming out of the woodwork to defend the movie.
I mean, listen, if anyone wants to challenge you for that title, go for it, but it's what, I remember...
You know what? To our listeners,
yeah.
Do you want the crown?
Yeah.
The Home on the Range kid crown?
Yeah, there was...
challenge each other. Try to out-trivia each other. I want to hear from you guys.
Oh, who is that one... who's that one YouTuber I like? He does, like, the animations, but she does, like, all the Mario, like, playthroughs, but she animates them.
Are you talking about Jaden Animations?
Jaden Animations.
Okay.
Jaden Animations
I saw her in public recently.
What? Yeah, I'm so jealous.
My wife is a big fan of the TV show Severance, and she got me into Severance, so I'm into the show Severance.
Jaden Animations on Severance?
She's not on it. She's into it. And so we went to this big Paley Fest event, which was in downtown Hollywood, and she was there.
What?
I didn't think she was local. Maybe she's not. Maybe she came out for it.
Maybe she travels a lot, yeah. Oh, shit. I'm really jealous. So, yeah, did you say anything?
No, we just saw her in a crowd.
She literally did a video saying that it's okay to come up to her and say hi, because everyone's usually very polite.
Yeah.
So I have permission.
My wife was able to recognize her and pointed her out to me.
I bring this up because Jaden Animation did a video once that was, she was getting really into speed runs, but it gets to the point where some people have speed run, I don't know, Super Mario Brothers, and all you can really do is try to shave off a fraction of a second.
Yeah, really good at that stuff.
So she was what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a speed run of a game no one has ever speed run before.
Oh, I think I've seen this one. It's like a cooking game.
Cooking Mama 2 or something like that. And so, but she took it really seriously, even though, by default, she would have the highest one. That's my point.
Mm.
Yeah. I kind of forgot what my point was.
Nobody's fighting over who gets to be the home on the ranch game.
Yeah, you win by default unless someone challenges you for the crown.
Anyway, continuing. Chicken Little. Oh God, Chicken Little. I have not seen that movie in maybe 15 years until recently. My girlfriend randomly threw it on when I arrived to her place, and she was like, I haven't seen this in forever. I don't remember much. I responded with, me too, but I watched it a lot when I was little. I think I straight up lied to her because I was able to tell her beat by beat the entire movie while it was happening in real time, and I was saying bits before it even happened. Like, I was able to sing One Little Sip by the Bare Naked Ladies. The worst part is I didn't even sit on the couch with her. I stood in front of the TV for an hour and a half with my arms crossed, just describing this movie to her. Something was unlocked within my subconscious that day, and I'm afraid it's here to stay. Now, I don't know how well-versed you are in Chicken Little lore, but I have some questions and grievances, and this is my letter. I'm going to do what I want. Number one, Chicken Little's dad's name is Buck Cluck. So wouldn't that make Chicken Little's name Chicken Cluck? Or is his whole existence based off the fact that he is a chicken and also little? What about when he grows up? When will he get bigger? Will he get bigger because he will get bitter because he's a child? Will he grow up into Chicken Cluck? Or is this a childhood nickname? What is his actual name? Personally, I think it's Bruce Cluck.
Okay.
Sure. Number two, this is a very mean movie. The whole town, including his own father, relentlessly bully Bruce Cluck because of a mental breakdown. So they think, those idiots.
Yeah, yeah.
And no one, and not the school psychologist, social worker, or even his own father, think, maybe we need to get him evaluated. Instead, the whole town relentlessly bullies him and belittles him, and he just takes it. Bruce's dad doesn't even reconcile with him and help him until the very end of the movie, when he is forced to face his trauma through a theater exercise. You know, I haven't seen this movie, so this is all nonsense.
It's starting to sound cool.
I might have to. It was directed by Mark Dindal, who did the movie Cats Don't Dance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He also did The Emperor's New Groove, and I'm fond of those movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Didn't he do something kind of weird recently?
He was behind something a little bit less playful recently. Yeah, I'd have to look it up. Yeah. That's all I have for you too, because I'm writing this on my lunch break and I'm running out of time. Until next time, gents, thank you for the great movie recommendations / reviews that I can add to my Letterboxd from you too. Shameless plug, MACLAU0 on Letterboxd.
Yeah, please follow them.
Anyway, stay groovy, Michael.
Two thoughts. One, I've never seen Chicken Little either, but from the way you describe it, and really just the plot of Chicken Little in any given version, I'm reminded of a line Thomas Harris wrote that they used in the Hannibal TV series. In the Hannibal TV series, Will was thrown into a mental institution because everyone thought he was a murderer. Mm-hmm. But he knew Hannibal Lecter was a murderer, but no one believed him. And there was this one moment where everyone's like, he's in his cell, and he's like smiling all creepy. I'm like, why are you smiling? And he's like, there is a feeling that everyone knows that we have never named, but we all recognize. It is the happy anticipation of being proven right. And I feel like that's Chicken Little. I interviewed Alan Menken once. And
the songwriter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He'd done so many of the great Disney musicals, and he had done Home on the Range. And I had asked him, he was just about to start working on the sequel to Enchanted. And we were also talking about how Hunchback got turned into a very successful stage show, even though it wasn't a terribly successful movie. And he said, if someone could figure out a way to turn Home on the Range into a musical play, then I'll know that hell has frozen over. And then he said, well, you know, the songs were good. It's the dumbest movie. And then a villain played by Randy Quaid yodeling. Come on, that's primal stuff. See, he was a funny man.
Cats Don't Dance, Emperor's New Groove. I looked up Mark Dindal.
Yeah, what he did.
Chicken Little. Oh, he did the Garfield movie.
That was
Mark Dindal. And you know what? That's kind of his sensibility. It's not as good a film.
No, it's okay. I mean, I didn't hate it, but
he's also attached to the Funko movie. They're doing a movie based on Funko Pops.
Well, you know, there's a part of me that thinks, and I know I've made this argument in the other direction before, but I'm starting to see that the insidiousness of it. That the fact that the Lego movie was good might have been a net negative. Because it makes us think any of these can. And granted, technically they can. But the optimism that they're going to reach Lego movie is unrealistic.
Yeah.
Like, it set the bar way too high. Like, Lego movie did it, Barbie did it. I will grant you both of those.
Yeah.
I don't hold out a lot of hope for a lot of those.
No. Yeah. And we've commented on this before, how we're now seeing a generation of filmmakers who are deeply branded by the media of their childhoods coming around with, like, deep attachments to products.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing Hollywood churn out biopics of not people, but of products.
Yeah.
There was that whole wave in, like, 2023 where you had, like, five or six of them in a single year. There was the Pop-Tarts movie. There was the Nike movie.
Oh, the movie's about the making of corporate products. Yeah. Air.
That was about the Air Jordan.
Blackberry.
There was the Beanie Baby craze.
There was the
Tetris movie. There,
yeah.
Like, the, that kind of stuff is sort of what's really leaking in now.
Well, we seem to have put a stop to that. I think we've stopped the bleeding on that particular Gusher. Oh, God, they're going to do a Gusher's one, aren't they?
Gusher's the movie.
No.
Oh, no, my head turned into a giant watermelon. Snack mommination.
We should move on.
Jesse writes.
Okay. Thank you, Elevated Train. Whitney lives near, like, an Elevated Train here in Los Angeles. And every time it goes by, I'm reminded of Brad Pitt's apartment in Seven.
The relaxing, vibrating home. Yeah. But it doesn't shake the house. It just passes
by
the
window. It is very loud.
Anyway, this says, "Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I recently listened to your critically acclaimed in which you talked about Predator, Killer of Killers. I have some disagreements about your analysis."
Fair.
Our analysis was, when I started watching Killer of Killers, I hated it, and I liked it by the end.
Okay.
When they finally reunited all the characters together, and I kind of saw, oh, wait, this was being set up all along.
My main critique was I thought the first, it's like four installments, and I thought the first two were pretty repetitive.
Yeah.
But
not a lot of personality, not a lot of character.
Maybe we're forgetting some nuance, and they're talking about that instead. So let's read that.
A small disclaimer: I really loved Killer of Killers, and it's probably my favorite of the Predator movies.
Wow.
To start, you mentioned the Predator franchise is constantly contradicting itself. While I agree, I don't think it's as big a deal in the new Trachtenberg era. It seems clear, based on the fact that he's moving forward through history, the past in Prey, moving forward through time in Killer of Killers, and then the future in the upcoming Badlands, that Trachtenberg is trying to make his own Predator lore. The only real evidence we have of any previous movies took place are a monster that looks kind of like a xenomorph in one of the freezer pods, and that a xenomorph's skull is in the trailer. That's the creature from the movie Aliens.
Yeah.
Is in the trailer for Badlands. The fact that a Predator only uses the heat vision in Killer of Killers doesn't seem to me like they forgot that the Predator can use other tech. It actually feels important to the movie as a whole. It seems to me that the Predator's downfall in all three segments is seeing things as binary. If you kill people, you are a killer. If the Predator and the Predator wants to kill you. Warm means alive, cold means dead. It feels more to me like a testament of how inherently non-binary we are as a people to be able to exist in more than one state simultaneously. If you step back and look solely at the standing at it standing within the franchise, you can say it should have been split into three, but the movie in and of itself is more complicated than I think you give it credit for. Thanks, Jesse. You know, I hadn't considered that.
You know, that's an interesting point. I really thought that out.
I was getting hung up on the mechanics of it. I wasn't even thinking of that.
I think that's fair. I think that's a perhaps a slightly generous read. I don't think the film necessarily, like, pops with that, but I do think it's a fair read.
Yeah, that's fair.
I think you really come up with some interesting stuff here. I will take issue with one thing, though. There's one, when you said about its connections to the other Predator movies, mentioned the Xenomorphs, etc., there is one very distinct connection, though, and that is at the end of Prey, we find out that a gun that Amber Midthunder's character, forget her name, had taken from, like, one of the French guys, was the exact same gun that the Predators gifted to Danny Glover at the end of Predator 2. So okay. It is connected directly to the lore, and Dan Trachtenberg definitely did that on purpose. So I don't think he's building his own lore from scratch. So I think there's a bit overlooked there, but that doesn't negate your overall interpretation of Killer of Killers, which, actually, good point. Mm. The fact that predators misinterpret us as being as being less complicated than we are. Of course, some of us are that uncomplicated, but that works, actually. I like that. Yeah. I like that a lot. I'll think about that.
That's actually something that is pervasive throughout a lot of science fiction. I noticed this as a teenager playing... I was actually playing a video game when this came to me, because I've been a big Trekkie going way back, and I started playing a game called Star Control 2.
I never played it, but I remember the
gimmick of Star Control 2 was its universe of like alien species, and just like on Star Trek, each alien species had like one personality.
Was that on like Nintendo or the computer?
No, it was on like PCs.
Okay, yeah.
And each one had a different design ship, and each ship had like a different gameplay mechanic. But I noticed that the humans had ships very much like on Star Trek, and they wore uniforms, and they all worked in this like sort of white gleaming environment, and they were very officious and bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. And I noted that I had seen enough science fiction movies at that point to see that humans were typically depicted as having the strength of unity, that diplomacy, and this of course was derived, I think, mostly from Star Trek. Other science fiction took it and ran with it, and other alien species were defined by some sort of passion, whereas human beings were defined by being sort of a little bit more nuanced and dispassionate and better in control of themselves.
Which, to be fair, is a lot of Star Trek as well. The Klingons are very passionate. The Ferengi are very passionate. The Romulans are very passionate.
So again, this is all derived from Star Trek, but it's become such a pervasive part of science fiction, we almost take it for granted now.
Yeah, I don't think everyone's doing Star Trek necessarily, but they definitely.
But you can even extend that into this theory about Predator, how human beings are actually a little bit more nuanced, whereas the Predators are just bloodthirsty.
Well, and that's something that when we have our own Star Trek podcast on our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, and we review every single Star Trek. So we've talked about Star Trek a lot, and one of the things that I talk about. I hope not too much, but somewhat regularly on Star Trek is, you know, the longer Star Trek goes, the more you start to question the things that they kind of just want you to take for granted. Uh-huh. And one of the things that Star Trek does, and I don't think it's always intentional, is it's very geocentric.
Yeah.
The idea is that humanity, for whatever our flaws, and we definitely are not all portrayed as saints on Star Trek, is the thing to aspire to. And if only the universe would be better if everyone's a little bit more like us. And granted, it's made by humans and it's made for humans, and I get it. But the longer you live in that world, the more you realize, I see why some people don't like Starfleet.
Because it's very human.
It's not just the human. Like, we think, they're officious and they're very well organized, and they kind of got an ego, don't they? They kind of think they're just the ones that come in and solve everything. The fuckers, you know?
And it always makes me bristle a little bit when they use the word humanity on Star Trek. Mm. Why not Vulcanity or any of the other species?
Well, that was in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Mm. We believe that everyone is has inalienable human rights. Oh, listen to yourself. Inalienable human. Everything about your ethos is racist. And she's not wrong.
And to be fair, this is something Trekkies have been complaining about for...
Well, yeah.
Since the start.
And the thing that's good about Trek is that they're constantly trying to improve on that.
And
you know?
I think Trekkies are willing to excuse it because we understand that the makers and the audience are at least 99% human.
Yeah.
So,
I was going to come up with a joke, but no. Yeah. I see. The point is, exactly. We were making it for a human audience, but again, the longer you spend in that world, the more time you have to question it.
Some of our closest friends claim to be human.
Right, moving on.
This is a letter from James. Hello, James.
Hi, James.
Messrs. Bibbs and McCool, with respect, I feel I must properly take you both to task for your analysis of Top Gun Maverick. Briefly espoused recently in your review of F1, also directed by Joseph Kosinski.
Okay.
First of all, I want to say that Maverick is pure cinema. It is one of the most exhilarating theater experience I've ever had. I still recall my heart pounding during its elongated climax. I saw it twice in theaters, and I never want to contribute another red cent to this abomination of a film. For all its
Oh, wow. Okay, I just did a whole, like, two-week, like, intensive seminar on film criticism. We studied the nuts and bolts in film criticism, and we talked about, like, the absolute importance of, like, having a great lead, and sometimes you bury it in order to reveal it at the end of a paragraph. A+.
Yeah.
Like, you really turned that around, and now I really want to hear more.
I saw it twice in theaters, and I never want to contribute another red cent to this abomination of a film.
Wow.
For all its pizzazz and triumphs of modern filmmaking, Maverick is also some of the slickest and most dangerous propaganda created since World War II.
Yeah, you're not
You're not right.
Same with Top Gun.
Yeah, the first Top Gun.
Yeah, absolutely.
In both Top Gun and Top Gun Maverick, they never state explicitly what country the American jets are fighting against.
They go out of their way.
So it's essentially, if you think about it, the rest of the world. Anything that's not American.
Anyone that opposes America is evil.
And must be murdered in a plane.
And they're completely dehumanized. We will never meet them as characters. Right. Yeah, it's really insidious. Yeah.
Well, I guess you wouldn't disagree with this premise. I heard you both agree that the central theme of the movie is, broadly speaking, masculinity. I think that's incidental.
Mm.
Here's the premise of Maverick puts forward. The United States military is underfunded, under-enrolled, and bogged down by bureaucrats to such an extreme that even rogue nations are now outgunning us with better technology. But not to worry, American exceptionalism will lead us to victory. But only if you give the military more money and fewer rules. This view does not require a deep between-the-lines reading of the film. This is a verbatim reading of the text of Maverick.
This is the text. This is not subtle, yeah.
This is all, of course, complete hogwash.
Yeah.
Did it again.
Yeah, that's good.
Each year, the president asks the Congress to fund the military. They ask for X billions of dollars, and Congress says yes without hesitation.
Yeah.
Then the military turns around the proverbial iPad tip screen, and Congress selects the highest option without blinking an eye.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that the military lost $2 billion last year just in bureaucratic shuffling?
I'm not surprised.
Like just $2 billion is not accounted for.
Yeah, just somewhere in the ether.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't surprise me. Mm-hmm. And I think of all the good that money could do. It boils my hide. They're disassembling the fucking Department of Education.
Mm-hmm. Which gets so little money anyway.
And we spent hundreds of millions of dollars to have Elon Musk's AI that recently called itself Mecha Hitler integrated into the Department of Defense. What the fuck are we doing?
I'm so glad we live in this timeline.
What? Yeah. I know that we're... You know what? We're already talking about some dark stuff. Sorry,
they select a... They get more of what they ask for every year. We spend more money on the military than any other nation by magnitudes, and because of that, we have the best and most advanced technology, and it's not even close.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get tens of billions more than they ask for each year, and then try to sell us on the idea that American pilots are flying around in the Ford Pinto of fighter jets, while our enemies have coveted seventh-generation fighters, to which we can only aspire. I'm not buying it.
No.
Furthermore, the idea that these sorts of operations would be broadly restricted by undue regulation is laughable. For one, the United States occupied a sovereign nation for almost a decade without Congress ever declaring war. To use a more recent example, the U.S. military recently conducted a unilateral strike against a nation's uranium enrichment facilities, ripped right from the pages of Maverick's script. What regulations, what rules?
Oh, shit, you're right, yeah.
Yeah. It seems like people know this about Maverick, but take it for granted or hand wave it away, and at the risk of sounding blunt, that's irresponsible.
Again, we use that word a lot.
Yeah, again, this is dangerous. It's dangerous to portray the U.S. military like this, and even more dangerous when it's this effective. And I don't think critics do a good job of discussing this film when they sweep this aspect under the rug. Top Gun Maverick is the exact type of jingoistic propaganda that should be setting off alarm bells in any discerning viewer.
Mm.
To be clear, I'm from a military family. It should go without saying that you can support troops without supporting the goals and actions of their commanding branch.
I'm from a military family, too. I totally get it.
To boot, I'm all for fun Go America movies, something like Independence Day, where it literally turns out July 4th into a global holiday by its end.
Yeah.
Because this is silly. It's not making any sort of polemic or call for policy changes. It's certainly not going to instill in its viewer any misleading ideals with the intent of drumming up support or for less oversight and more money. So again, with all respect, call a spade when you're talking about a spade. So, sign James.
Fair enough, James. I'm going to say a couple of things. One, I agree with pretty much everything you say about Top Gun Maverick.
Yeah.
I appreciate that you're capable of holding two conflicting ideas in your head at once. That A, the movie is very good, and B, the movie is very evil.
Yeah.
Things are both true. It is impeccably crafted. It is exhilarating to watch. And you're right, that's what makes it dangerous. And this is one of the reasons why when people say, oh, why are critics even bothering criticizing these mainstream movies? Because that's the one everyone sees. And because they are presented as broad entertainment, we are encouraged, if not outright told, not to think about it. Turn off your brain, we're told. Turn off your brain means just don't question.
Don't engage with the politics.
Yes,
The bigger and more popular a movie is, the more we need to interrogate its messages, because it's a message that's being broadcasted to many, many people.
And sometimes the messages are good.
Often they are. And in fact, most mainstream Hollywood blockbusters you'll find contain themes of hope and triumph.
Overcoming adversity, helping the underdog. Superman.
Fighting evil.
Superman's got a lot of good messages in it.
The new Superman movie has all of the themes that are in just about every summer blockbuster.
Every summer blockbuster is talking about what's happening in Palestine right now? Come on.
I'm talking about themes of broader themes of like hope and triumph and good triumph and
over
evil. I'm
saying Superman is at least trying to be more specific as well. At least to its credit.
Yeah. But I've heard a lot of people talk about how, you know, Superman is unique because it's about hope. No, every summer blockbuster is kind of about hope on at least one level.
That's a little broad, but I do see your point.
Yeah. So sometimes, yes, the messages are very, very positive. But often the messages, even without the filmmakers necessarily intending it, are coming across as really irresponsible.
And
I think we even said Top Gun Maverick was irresponsible when we reviewed it.
I think we initially reviewed it. We talked about this a lot. Here's what I will say. And it's tricky because sometimes when you bring up a movie, especially when it's not specifically the movie you're talking about, you want to bring up an aspect of it, but you don't necessarily want to talk about the entire movie, because if we start talking about the entirety of every movie we reference, we will never end the podcast. So that is a battle. Maybe we lost that battle this time. But I will say this. When we were referring to Top Gun being about masculinity, and if we made it sound like it had nothing else on its mind, we were inaccurate about that, and we didn't express ourselves well. It is also about masculinity, and F1 is not military propaganda. That is not a crossover. It's
commercial propaganda.
It's Formula One racing propaganda. No argument about that. But it is not the insidious military industrial complex propaganda. So when we talk about how it is essentially a remake of Top Gun Maverick, we're not talking about every aspect. Obviously, aspect is an overlap. But the aspect of masculinity and the power of the 50, 60-year-old rebellious white male to fix everyone who was broken by that white male's interpretation, just by dint of being cool. in that regard, they're the same movie.
Yeah.
But I agree. Obviously, we left a lot out.
Yeah, to transpose the dangers of the military-industrial complex with the crass commercialism of over-moneyed auto racing events, which we still have those. That's a little odd. Auto racing. I want vroom vroom go fast. It's like, what are you proving there?
That's true for almost any sport if you think about it.
I live in LA. I don't need a fast car. There's too much traffic.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. Maybe that's the fantasy. It's like you get to be in a place where there's no traffic.
Yeah.
You get to go with that.
I'm going to get one of the super fast cars and then move to Montana. There's no traffic in Montana.
Yeah. But, you know, fair point. And I agree with your larger overall conceit there. Yeah, you're not wrong. Moving on.
Here's a letter.
Thank you for writing.
Thank you for writing. Here's a letter from Dr. T, but not the women.
Oh.
Dr. T says, "Dear Captain McCool and Commander Bibiani." Oh, I get to be the captain.
Yep, that's fair.
Long time.
I haven't put in the hours, it's fine.
No, you.
I was offered my own podcast, but I turned it down. I wasn't ready yet.
No, it was that time you were subordinate and you got demoted. Long-time listener, several times writer. I am also a neurodivergent psychiatrist with a predictable deep fascination with the history of my profession. So hearing your discussion on how mental health treatment is depicted on screen tickled something deep in my brain. I could give you a 30-minute lecture on the history of the field and still not touch on it, on everything. So I'll try to do broad strokes with this, the way almost any mental institute, with this period, excuse me. This, by the way, is titled Frame of Mind, which is a Star Trek episode.
Oh, it is, yeah. Yeah. Oh, so this is a reference to that Star Trek episode where we talked about. Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, to put it into context.
Recently, we did a Star Trek episode. Did they mention that? Recently, we did a Star Trek episode in our yesterday's podcast. We already talked about it on the Patreon, in which the subject was mental illness. The character of Commander Riker was doing a play in which he was in a mental institution and questioning his sanity, and then he started actually questioning his sanity.
Yeah, and thought he was in the mental institution and could possibly have been.
Yeah, and whatever it was dramatically, it played into a lot of familiar cliches, narrative cliches, dramatic cliches about how those institutions operate, whether they're accurate or not.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm very curious to see what you have to say. So with that context.
So yeah, Dr. T says, the way almost any mental institution is presented on film, for some reason the first movie to come to my mind was Shutter Island.
Okay.
They're often depicted as what are called Kirkbride asylums.
Hmm.
Dr. Kirkbride was an American psychiatrist in the mid-19th century, and he developed a particular plan that he thought would promote healing. These are the kinds of sprawling Gothic buildings, which to a contemporary look very imposing, but in their time were actually very welcoming open places.
Hmm.
Because despite the intimidating grandeur of the central building, they had wings that were reasonably open, and the grounds would often include working farms or gardens that would give patients inactivity beyond just being trapped in their own heads.
Yeah.
These were originally private institutions. But after the Civil War, states assumed control of more and more of them, with the predictable overcrowding and budget cuts making them less welcoming and more like prisons.
Mm.
The darkest period for the field was probably the early 20th century, where Bibbs correctly notes, a man could basically imprison his wife and have her lobotomized for essentially any reason.
Yeah.
With the development of the first effective antipsychotic medication, Thorazine, in the 1950s, this began to humanize the field a bit. They accelerated underneath the Kennedy administration because JFK had watched his sister Rosemary, who was likely on the spectrum, lobotomized and essentially tortured in one of those kinds of facilities. The plan was to phase out the institutional model and shift to the community-based treatment. That was largely accomplished during Jimmy Carter's presidency with the passage of a landmark bill called the Mental Health Systems Act, authored heavily by Ted Kennedy, as a matter of fact, which would have been truly transformative.
I hate would have. That's not a great start.
Had Ronald Reagan.
Of course.
Not turned around and gutted it a year later. And here we are 40 plus years on and fewer resources.
Oh, Reagan.
There's an old saying that we have here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Think of something wrong with America. Anything.
Mm-hmm.
Think of one thing that's just wrong about America.
Like today.
Today. Blame Reagan.
Yeah.
You're going to be right more often than you're going to be wrong.
If you look at like every like bit of progress that we're making in the nation, economically, social, whatever, it's... Keeps going. It's going. We hit the Reagan era, and then it plateaus for a bit, but then it goes way the hell down.
Crashes down.
Yeah.
And we're going through a, like, Reagan, juiced up Reagan era now.
We keep fetishizing those, those years, and B, that administration. Mm. Like, and it's wrong to do both.
Well,
like,
and what is Donald Trump?
It's a very political episode of We've Got Mail, by the way. I'm acknowledging it. We don't always do this, you know.
Consider, what is Trump? He's one of Reagan's yuppies. Like,
he was
yuppie,
the prototypical.
That yuppie class of, you know, gold-digging hard scrabblers. Yeah. That's Trump.
Not that this was a documentary, but in American Psycho, like, it's like one of the few people that, like, Patrick Bateman is like, ooh, Donald Trump is in that car. Like, you know, like, he's actually, like,
He's Patrick Bateman's hero. That's what you need to know about our president.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever see the American Psycho musical?
Oh, I didn't.
Oh, it's so fucking good. It was really fucking good.
There's more to this.
I digress.
Anyway, your discussion got me thinking about how my own field is often depicted on film. You probably wouldn't be surprised if I answer generally poorly.
Mm.
I'm going deep into my memory for a movie, but the best I can give you is Good Will Hunting.
Mm.
Sean clearly over-identifies with Will as I do with my own queer and or patients on the spectrum, but counter-transference is only a problem when you don't recognize it in a run checks to make sure it's not affecting your judgment.
Okay.
The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
So these are good examples.
These are good examples.
Yeah, yeah.
And an early Brie Larson role in a film called Short Term 12.
Oh,
the latter is about a worker at a residential treatment center for teenagers with psychiatric illnesses and pretty much nails both the rewards and the challenges and the day in and day out grind of the job.
Mm.
Hard to believe Destin Daniel Cretton went from that to Shang-Chi. But here we are. Yeah.
Chung-Chi is one of the better, more recent ones.
It's not like Short-Term 12,
No,
however.
It's very, very not. But whatever. He clearly likes martial arts movies. Like, yeah. He understood a lot of what made them work.
Yeah.
I'll give him credit for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Hire Tony Leung. That was his secret.
That was a good secret. Yeah. That was smart, man. Whoever's genius idea
and
that was.
And just stick Michelle Yeoh in there. She'll show up.
Yeah, can we get her? Like, what
give, give, her yeah. give it a little cred. Yeah.
I don't think she's in that one, though.
She is?
But she was also in Guardians of the Galaxy, though.
Was she?
Yeah, she had a small role in the second one. She was like one of the...
Yeah, she was definitely in Shang-Chi. I don't remember in Guardians of the Galaxy.
There was, if you recall... We're in the weeds. I'll make this quick. If you recall, in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, we meet a series of characters, some of them like Sylvester Stallone, who were like actually the original Guardians of the Galaxy in the comics.
Yeah.
But now they're like older and they've been around. Mm. And Michelle Yeoh was one of them. So she only was in a couple of scenes. But it was a cameo. It was a glorified cameo. Yeah.
Sorry for the length of this, but in closure, do either of you have a favorite depiction of this? I can't call The Silence of the Lambs a positive depiction of either mental health or queerness, and yet I'd be lying if I said it didn't have a significant impact on my career choice. Thanks for all that you do. All Our Yesterdays makes my commute a little less stressful. Signed, Dr. T.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. That's a good question, and again, we're not experts in this.
No, and I've said this a lot. I understand that when Hollywood movies, especially American Hollywood films, deal with mental illness, maybe 90% of the time, we're going to be getting the Hollywood version, which is to say a wildly inaccurate version. Sanitized at best, sometimes based on bits of fact, mostly turned into something dramatic for a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of having like split personalities, that's something for movies. The way we see them in movies,
that's a real condition, but the movie version of it is
identity dissociative disorder is a real thing, but it doesn't look like it does in the movies. That's what I mean. Like it's based on bits of fact, but the movie Split is not a psychologically accurate movie.
That's one of the things I actually hated about Split.
That's hokum. It's not until the very end of the movie that you realize, oh, wait a minute, it's playing by fantasy rules.
Yeah.
This was meant to be a fantasy from the start.
Yeah, I kind of wish they'd tipped their hand a little earlier at that. I would have been a little bit more forgiving, because for a while it's like, wow, this is really fucking, here's the word, irresponsible.
Yeah.
When you're portraying something that not everyone is aware of, and you don't portray it in a fair or accurate or positive light, not that that always warrants positivity, but you run the risk of people getting the wrong fucking message about it, don't you?
We watched a movie for Only the Best recently called The Snake Pit, which was pretty affecting. I also am very fond of Shock Corridor.
Shock Corridor is great. I don't have no idea if it's that.
I can't speak if either of the Snake Pit feels like they did a little bit of research.
I think Snake Pit was aiming for accuracy, how accurate they were. Snake Pit is a film from the late 1940s about a woman who has mental health problems and is put in an institution, and the institution has like various levels of like institutionalization and security. So like if there's like level
they
one,
they become more like prisons the further
it gets really bleak for a while. At the time it was touted for its accuracy. I don't know how accurate it actually was, but it's a good movie. Corridor is. I mean, if you told me it was Samuel Fuller, right? Samuel Fuller made all of that up, I'd believe you, because it feels like it's out of a nightmare.
Yeah,
it's a really, really terrifying film. It's a great film. I somehow doubt it's terribly accurate, but like I don't know.
These are great movies. I am interested in movies when they actually bother to get the psychology of certain conditions correct.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they're diagnosed in the movie, or whether or not somebody goes to a mental health professional.
Yeah.
I'm very fond of The Piano Teacher, the Michael Haneke film. That deals with a certain kind of sexual hysteria very accurately. Mm. Because
hysteria is a loaded term, actually, with that.
I suppose so.
That's not great. But sexual... psychological
sexual fears, issues with sexuality, those are all dealt with very directly in The Piano Teacher.
The word hysteria was often ascribed to people who wanted to institutionalize.
Especially, I'm talking about a female character. It's very loaded. I apologize for that. But
thank you for noticing.
In fact, I didn't see it, but Maggie Gyllenhaal was in a film called Hysterical, which is about that. It was about the invention of the vibrator.
Yeah, because it was invented as like a medical thing. Like, women are coming to orgasm, things will be better. Yeah. Like, well, yes, actually, not sure exactly for the reason you're thinking, but yes, you're not wrong.
So yeah, that film was knew what it was doing when it was using that word.
Yeah,
but I had actually known a little bit about sort of the things that the main character, Erica is the character's name, played by Isabelle Huppert, was actually facing in that movie and the traumas it was based on. And I actually had a little bit of personal knowledge through people I know that what was going on in that movie was very, very accurate.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, a movie that I'm really ambivalent on because it gets one thing really accurate, but gets another thing really inaccurate is Secretary. Because Secretary is actually very kink positive.
Extremely kink
positive. Very, very,
it's very understanding.
Cathartic about how a certain kind of kink and power play can be a very cathartic experience.
And very healthy.
And explored healthy and explored within limits and actually a very loving experience between two people.
And it's nothing that you need to necessarily be ashamed over.
Yeah, exactly. and there's not shame attached. And this kind of play is actually a very healthy, good thing.
Yeah.
But they tie that into the phenomenon of cutting.
Yeah.
Which I think it completely whiffs.
And it suggests too much.
And it suggests that kink is actually like a one-to-one replacement for that,
that movie, and listen, I'm not saying it's accurate, I think that movie isn't really going for that. I think it's suggesting that here's someone who hadn't figured out what they actually wanted, but they still whiff it. Like, a lot of my movies that I think are really interesting about that environment are, you know, kind of surreal. You mentioned Shutter Island, which is, of course, basically a horror movie. William Peter Blatty did a film called The Ninth Configuration. You ever see that?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's not an accurate movie, I would suspect, but it's about a guy who starts running a mental institution for soldiers with PTSD and the like. But a lot of them have very specific, very vivid fantasy lives. And what he decides to do is, as a sort of a radical form of treatment, just say, let's indulge every single one of their fantasies. Mm-hmm. You want to do an inversion of Hamlet with entirely dogs? We will get you the dogs. You'll have to, like, this Cocker Spaniel is great! Like, and I think it goes to some odd places. I'm not entirely sure it works, but I think it's fascinating. But I don't think, I'd be surprised if even William Peter Blatty thought it was accurate. I think he was going for kind of a surrealism.
It's like Murat Saad these aren't meant to be accurate.
I'm always fascinated by like videos online of like people who really know what they're talking about, like a job or part of the government or the military or whatever, and they watch movies, and even good movies, and they say, this isn't accurate, and let me explain why. The League Legal used to do that a lot. He doesn't really do it much anymore, but he would take, like, you know, The Rainmaker.
He did it with Star Trek. He did it with Measure of a Man.
He did Measure of a Man. He did it with My Cousin Vinny. He did it with an episode of The Simpsons. Like, and he would just say,
this is how a real courtroom looks as opposed to this TV.
Yeah, yeah. Like, one thing that always drives him nuts is that in every movie about, you know, lawyers, court proceedings, the lawyer will leave their desk
and walk around in the courtroom
in front of the person that they're interrogating on the witness stand, or go right up to the jury, and apparently the bailiff would tackle you if you even tried.
Yeah.
That's just not, but we accept it because it's a movie. It's a little bit more dramatic that way, and he accepts it too, but it always bugs him. Like, I'm always fascinated by that, and there are certain things that I know about more than other things. Again, I was raised in a military family. I didn't really have too much direct contact with that, because my dad had already retired by the time I was born, but my parents are both educators, and anytime I see teachers in movies and television, I'm usually driven up the wall by how inaccurate it is. Yeah. And although it's very silly, I will say Abbott Elementary tries really, really hard.
Okay.
I think they mostly get it right, and I think that's, and they use that to fuel comedy and drama, and they do a really good job, because I remember I've seen a lot of shows that didn't. We're outside our lane here, and I'm sure a lot of the things that we're talking about are wildly inaccurate. But I did appreciate, thank you for giving us a few examples of movies that you think were responsible and did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
Because that would have been my follow-up question. So, but thank you. Thank you for writing it. This is actually really important, I think, and we don't talk about it enough. I'm a firm believer in having more conversations about mental health in public.
Yeah.
I think it's been overly stigmatized for way too long. I still know people who aren't comfortable talking about their mental health struggles at all, even with friends and family.
What you were talking about, the Lego movie, I think we can also attribute to something like Psycho.
Yes.
Psycho had that really awkward scene at the end where the psychiatrist kind of explains Norman Bates' neuroses.
After talking to him for like an hour or two. Yeah. Like he just nailed it, apparently.
And the idea is Norman Bates is a murderer. He's killed numerous people, but he also has dissociative identity disorder. So he like murders people, but only when he dissociates into this persona of his mother.
Yes, and we may be using this terminology wrong, but we're trying to describe the plot.
This is the plot of Psycho. And what that scene did, and even using the title Psycho rather than murderer, lent a little wisp of psychological credence to this potboiler about a guy who stabs people.
Made it feel like it did some research.
Yeah, it felt like a little bit more legit than some of the thrillers on either side of it.
Which may have been what Hitch was going for, but again, that might have been irresponsible.
That's definitely what Hitchcock was going for. Yeah. But you start looking at slashers that happened for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
And they all tried to do something really similar. They tried to set up the psychology of a murderer when what they really wanted to do was just have the kills.
They wanted to justify it. They wanted to feel like they had a real character. Yeah, I think even more dangerous thing that Psycho did was, whether this was the intention or not, because I think Joseph Stefano wrote that script, right? And he was queer, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. It associated a person dressing up in woman's clothing, like a person who identifies as a man. Because in sequels, he doesn't identify as a woman. That's complicated, and I don't think they really were. I don't think they understood anything they were talking about. But the idea was people who present themselves differently than the gender to which people would conventionally ascribe them, there's an element of menace to it.
Yeah, and that lasts all the way into The Silence of the Lambs.
And beyond. And beyond. And that's not good. That should not be an immediate association.
I think Brian De Palma had that in more than one movie. Brian De Palma's, let's be fair, he's Hitchcock Jr. anyway.
He's always been pretty upfront about that. Yeah. But like, he's always been doing those riffs. And we have a lot to answer for. We're talking about responsibility here. And I think some of these are more intentional than others. I mean, Top Gun is definitely intentionally propaganda.
Yes.
Both of them. Whether they think that's all there is to it is irrelevant. It definitely is part of it. I think some of these movies are people who don't know better. They just want to do a fun horror movie or a horror movie that sounds smart. And I think that a lot of them, you know, that may be subconscious that they fucked it up and went really dark and gave some really bad ideas. But a lot of them are presented as if we did research and not necessarily. Or the research we did was later disproven. That's also a thing.
So Psycho gave psychological credence, but I'm thinking to like some of the other slashers. Michael Myers was just evil, and I appreciate that. Rob Zombie changed his backstory. Yeah. In the 1978 Halloween, his shrink steps forward and says, "I've been dealing with this kid. He said nothing. He's just evil."
Yeah.
Like, that's it. And he grew up into this evil murderer. He's like semi-supernatural. We don't need psychology for Michael Myers. There's no psychology for Michael Myers.
I think that's
part
of the point, is that by that point, we'd put so much power into the idea of psychologists knowing everything, thanks in part to Psycho, one of the characters. One of the characters in Halloween is named after a character in Psycho. Clearly, John Carpenter was influenced. But when you take that psychologist and say, "Listen, I know everything there is to know about psychology," this person defies that and is pure menace.
Yeah.
And that's really, really scary. And I think Rob Zombie, after that being sort of unquestioned for decades, said, "What if, hear me out here, what if Loomis was full of shit? What if Loomis wasn't a good shrink?" And then all of a sudden, you have a very different narrative. And you start questioning everything Loomis says. And maybe Michael Myers was just a person with problems that his psychologist or psychiatrist or whoever would have been responsible for that failed. It's a failure. Like, someone just wasn't up to the task. I those movies grew on me over time. I was very against them initially, and I think now, especially Halloween 2, I think Halloween 2 is really excellent. But
I have to watch it again, because I remember just being totally off-put by how bonkers it was.
Watch the director's cut. That it's, like, not bonkers, but I think it's more assured, and I think it's more clear what the creative decisions are.
Like, he was going for, like, some surrealism and failing.
Oh, yeah.
And,
no,
like,
it just
didn't work out for me.
He was like, fuck it, I'm still going to riff on a few things. There is going to be a sequence at a hospital, that kind of shit, but, like... Yeah, he's doing his own thing, man. Yeah. He's just completely split out. But the idea that Loomis doesn't know what he's talking about does definitely come into Halloween too.
All right,
we should move on. We have time for a couple more letters.
This is a letter from Brandon. Hello, Brandon.
Hi, Brandon.
Dear William and Whitney, I first started enjoying your wit and personality at the movie Trivia Schmodown.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
rest
in peace, movie Trivia. I miss the people.
Mm-hmm.
I was a terrible competitor, but I miss being around that crowd.
You and I were good together. We had some bad luck. Every time we had like a major match, we kind of whiffed it. But we were really we'd set like several records. Actually, we did really good. But yeah, every weekend or every other weekend, we would all meet with a whole bunch of people who do what we do and love what we love, and we got to play, and that was fun.
It was a movie trivia competition, staged like a wrestling match. So there was all this like kayfabe, and people were yelling at each other.
It was really fun.
We all had our personalities. It was idiocy, but it was a lot of fun.
A lot
of that stuff's still on YouTube. You can watch old Snowdowns on YouTube.
I think some of them have been like reposted, and like you can't see how many views they once had, which is a bit of a bummer. Mm-hmm. I'm still amazed that one's done like a. Because people do, like, video documentaries about, like, hey, remember this one penguin game that we all used to play online? Or, hey, remember this one creepypasta? And I'm like, I'm surprised no one's ever done, like, a big one about the movie Trivia Schmodown. I feel not for me. You can leave me out of it. I don't give a shit. I just think it was interesting that this weird intersection of all these different personalities did something really fun. I
got to do an exhibition match. Just a little bit of a side.
Because
I was actually thinking about this today. I got to do an exhibition match. Mm-hmm. It was horror trivia with the cast of Ash vs. Evil Dead.
Yeah.
So I wasn't the star. They were the stars, but they needed like some Schmodown personalities to kind of like
give it some
ballast, as it were.
Yeah.
So I was paired with an actress named Dana DiLorenzo, who very fun, very charming, very attractive. Like she was dazzling, and she was my partner, and I was just distracted by how dazzling she was. And Bruce Campbell was the host. He was asking the questions.
I'm so jealous of you, by the way. I really wish I could have been a part of that.
And I forgot the other actor from Ash vs. Evil Dead, but he was paired with the late, great John Schnepp.
Yeah, John Schnepp.
Yeah, rest in peace, John Schnepp.
What a lovely man.
He was a wonderful, wonderful man. He did that Superman documentary, but he was also kind of a friend of ours through the Schmodown.
Yeah, we didn't know him terribly well, but I only had positive experiences with him. He was lovely.
But Bruce Campbell had his Bruce Campbell persona.
Was it Ray Santiago?
It was Ray Santiago. Okay, that was it. It was John Schnepp and Ray Santiago, and it was me and Dale DiLorenzo, and Bruce Campbell was asking the questions. And they were dirt easy. Like, who is Sigourney Weaver's character from Alien? And the actors, they actually didn't know that stuff. So it's like I got to lean in and give the correct answer.
Yeah.
Bruce Campbell fucked up everything. Like, He was like reading things wrong. He had that vibe of I don't want to be here, but you know I'm too cool for the room. So it's
I can get away with it.
Yeah, so I can get away with it. And I think that's just sort of his vibe in general.
Oh, yeah, he can get away with it.
And of course he can get away with it. And I think he knows he can, and we don't mind. So not a big deal. They wouldn't let me do the joke that I wanted to do.
Oh no, what was the joke?
Because there was an intro sequence where it was me and John Schnepp, just the two of us on camera, arguing, saying, I know movie trivia better than you, I know horror trivia better than you, and John Schnepp is like, no, I know better than you. And then Bruce Campbell comes out from behind a curtain and says, I will test you two with my friends from Ash vs. Evil Dead. Mm-hmm. And we go, wow, it's Bruce Campbell, and that's the introduction.
Yeah.
When Bruce Campbell came out, I wanted me and John Schnepp to say in unison, wow, Campbell Scott. And like complete assholes. No one took my suggestion. No one liked that idea.
I think Campbell Scott might be a little unrecognizable to a lot of you. Maybe
I suppose
if there had been another famous Campbell you could have put in there. Yeah. But anyway, we should read the letter.
We should read the actual letter.
For Christ's sake. Okay.
Anyway, I met you through the movie Trivia Schmodown, then branched out into your podcasts. Whitney's Eraserhead intro is one of the most brilliant bits of the Schmodown, and I've really been digging the Thank Godzilla It's Friday and Holy Batman podcast series. Those
Thank
are
you so
old
much.
Back episodes you can listen to if you're a subscriber.
I helped film the Eraserhead intro, by the
you
way.
You did.
I was very honored. You
let me into
you
your
really
building
good.
To do a bit.
Yeah.
Also drove behind a grocery store to do part
yeah.
of it. I saw the title of the most recent Iron List episode and thought it would be fun to put together my top 10 movies, starting with the letter L.
Hey, great.
Before listening to your pick. So this is pre our
yeah, sure.
intros.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is from starting at 1 and going down to 10.
That's fine.
Number 1 is The Lion King from 1994.
Fair enough.
This is my actual number 1 choice. The Circle of Life and the Walk Up Pride Rock are basically the perfect beginning and ending to a movie that still gives me the chills. The music by Elton John, Tim Rice, Hans Zimmer, Lebo M., and the other collaborators stands the test of time, and the animation is wonderful throughout. Mufasa and Pumbaa are two of my favorite movie characters. I watched the VHS multiple times a week when it came out, and I'm happy to watch the movie anytime to this day.
It's a really well-made film.
Yeah.
I'm glad
I finally watched it.
Yeah, it is.
Because I saw the remake first.
Yeah, it's a lot better, right? You can agree with that? Like, it's actually good,
it's,
you know?
A bit better. Yeah.
Yeah, you can see, like, exactly how that remake went off the rails, or rather, went back on the rails. Why are we... Anyway.
My only complaint about The Lion King is I wish Simba hadn't gone back to reclaim his kingdom.
Yeah.
I wish he had stayed with Timon and Pumbaa and just lured the lions there, because they were actually living a much better life.
Was it you and I who were talking about how I think the real thing Simba could have done is, listen, I know I heard all about the Circle of Life shit, but I've been living with Timon and Pumbaa for a really long time. We don't have to eat the antelope.
Yeah.
We could eat grub worms and shit. And listen, I know what you're thinking.
A scene like that.
I know what you're thinking. But I know they're slimy. But
they're satisfying,
damn it. Like, we could really just upend this whole paradigm, and that is how we get to Zootopia.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's a prequel.
There you go.
I'm omitting descriptions or reviews of these other movies just to keep this letter a manageable length.
Oh, we've already screwed that up.
Oh, yeah, sorry. We went off on a big tangent just for ourselves.
Yeah.
Number 2, The Lord of the Rings, the 3 Peter Jackson movies.
I'm assuming the first 3, because he did the other...
Well, but those don't start with L. Those start with...
The Hobbit movies
start with H.
Yes, agree. And great films.
Number 3, The Little Mermaid from 1989. Another animated picture.
Another classic.
4, The Last Jedi. Star Wars episode 8, The Last Jedi.
You're kind of fudging the L on that one, since it's technically Star Wars The, but I'll let you have it. I love that movie.
It's my second favorite Star Wars movie.
Yeah, probably mine too, yeah.
Yeah.
Top 2 or 3, yeah.
I like Star Wars, and then I like The Last Jedi. Those are my 2 favorites.
I put Empire in there somewhere, with kind of in a jumble. Where I'd stand today might be not where I stand tomorrow, but those are the top 3,
Embarrassingly, the one I've seen the most is the holiday special.
That's so fucking Whitney.
I've seen the holiday special about
That's
6
so
times.
Fucking Whitney. Oh my god.
Like, I've seen it repeatedly. I saw it with riff tracks.
Oh.
We did a commentary track, so I watched it again then. I've seen Star Wars twice.
Whitney.
I've seen Spaceballs a couple dozen times.
Oh my god.
But I haven't seen much Star Wars.
Okay.
I come into cinema sideways.
That's like saying the Halloween movie I've seen the more than any other is Resurrection.
Halloween 3, yeah.
No, it's Resurrection.
Resurrection.
3 makes sense. Resurrection, nobody... you see Busta Rhymes fight Michael Myers, you don't need the rest of the movie. That's the only clip you need.
I mean... That's the height of the series.
Doesn't Roundhouse
isn't it?
Kick him? Like, I'm down. Like,
yeah, Kung Fu.
Yeah.
Michael Myers. Number 5 is The Lady Vanishes from 1938.
Love it. Love that movie so much.
Number 6 is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the version from 2005.
Okay.
Chronicles of Narnia picture.
Yeah. Okay.
7 through 9, Lego movies. 1, 2, and Batman.
All right.
Lego Batman's pretty fun.
And
the first Lego movie... The second Lego movie, they kind of repeat the gag a little bit.
Yeah, it's still pretty good. Like, if it was the only Lego movie, we'd be singing its praises, but we knew the first one did it better, so it didn't quite stand up. But those are all three really good movies.
And number 10 is Luca, another animated picture.
Oh, there you go.
Let's see, 3, 4, 5 animated pictures on there.
That's fine.
Honorable mentions, Lightyear, another animated film.
Okay.
Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay.
License to Kill. The James Bond movie?
There's a contingent of people who are like really starting to like claim that's one of the best Bond movies. I don't personally agree, but I do see their argument. Because that was, before we had Casino Royale, that was the one that was trying to be dark and a little gritty, even though it had Wayne Newton in it, so it could only go so far. But like, they were trying, you know?
But also they're like writing... Was that the one where they turned the truck sideways and...
was that the one?
Or...
It was the only two Daltons.
It was either Lessons in Skill of the Living Daylights. I don't remember which one. Right. And The Little Prince, the one from 2015.
Oh, bold choice. Yeah, a lot of controversy over that one. I know some people who hate that movie just because it takes huge liberties
from the source material.
I think you do it with purpose, but it's a good pick. Good pick.
I hope to discover more cool L movies from your lists, as this was harder to find great ones for in my own personal history. Thanks for providing a steady stream of quality reviews, banter, and tangents. Well, happy to provide tangents. Signed, Brandon. Well, thank you, Brandon.
Thank you very much. We love to see other people's lists. We do. So thank you, everyone who sends them in. We're always grateful. Excuse me.
You all right there?
Yeah, that was like a weird half hiccup, half gasp. I don't know what that was. That was odd. Okay, well, anyway. Huh. Yeah, I have to talk to my doctor about that. Moving on. We have time for one more.
All right. Let's see here. This is a letter from James, a different James.
Okay.
WB and RM. That's me, Rockmeister.
Right.
James here. Lots to cover, so I'll get down to it.
Okay.
Number one. I heard about your new living situation in the last episode of letters, vis-a-vis your cats not being allowed at your new rental. Mm. You mentioned exploring a workaround, but didn't go into specifics. I am a rental manager, and I want to offer you some advice.
Oh, thank you.
Even if you're already taking this route, it's good for audiences to know, too. First and most importantly, pet rent is theft, and anyone should do everything they can to avoid it.
Yes.
The best way is to get one of your... one or more of your animals recommended as an emotional support animal. This is a federally regulated concept that supersedes any state or private regulation. Read, landlords are compelled to accept it. Landlords must allow you to have your emotional support animals with no additional charges. There's also a kind of gray market of ESA letters where you can essentially pay like $10 to $15 to some doctor in your state that you've never visited to send you a stock letter testifying that you need an emotional support animal, and that's all it takes. That being said, from what you've been brave enough to share, it sounds like you wouldn't have a hard time getting a legit letter from a doctor who actually treated you.
Yeah.
While this may seem shady, fuck landlords and fuck pet rent.
God, pet rent is the fucking evilest fucking thing.
So I'm okay with, I don't mind smashing some shit to the ground.
I want to do it in a way that's actually like legally viable, so this is really good advice, but
In fact,
Pet rent is evil.
He even says, never lose a wink of sleep for however you gain ground on the ruling class. Eat the rich, steal from your employers, etc.
You are not wrong about any
fuck
of that.
Yes, all
right. And I had already had someone tell me that emotional support animal could be a workaround for that. Yeah. I probably will. I might have to get another cat at some point, but I think it's in the cards eventually. Yeah. Yeah.
Get a little stripey guy. I like the little stripey kitties.
Here's the deal. We can say, oh, I'd like a gray cat or a stripey cat or orange cat or whatever. The cat finds you.
Yeah, that's true.
And then you don't get to pick the cat. The cat, when you're ready, the cat will appear, in my experience. So,
his name is Tostado. We found him in a dumpster.
I mean,
And they saved
your life.
We found
Luca in an alley. I mean, like, he was a little kitten. He'd been kind of abandoned. Mm-hmm. He was covered in fleas, like, and dangerously so. Mm-hmm. And, he became our little guy.
Number two. You fielded a question in the same episode about movies that hate movies.
Mm.
Only one comes to mind, Birdman, or the unexpected virtue of not having dumb secondary titles. I loathe this movie's smug self-importance and dismissal of popular cinema. Oh, that's why I like it. it's a bitter screed from a man who has done nothing to earn his anger, being routinely lauded by the industry. That's true. The filmmaker has no reason to be angry at Hollywood.
Yeah,
he's gotten two Oscars 2 years in a row in Inarritu 2. He's doing all right.
Well, I think Birdman was his first, but to be fair. But still, he had been remarkably successful, completely eschewing the Hollywood system. I think the reason why people gave that a pass is because you could argue that Michael Keaton knows a lot about that. But it's not his movie, is it?
No.
Great performance. I think he has a great performance. But yeah, I agree. I think that movie is
It's all about how Hollywood popular cinema has ruined film to the point where you can only find true artistry on the stage. The so-called distinction between high art and low art has always come off to me as classist and elitist.
It is.
A good counter to this is The Menu. I find the haute cuisine versus cheeseburger metaphor to be quite clever in a dead-on representation of high art versus low art debate, but without really looking down on either of them.
Mm-hmm.
The central thesis is that any art, as long as it's made with love and passion, passion is worth consuming, and that only pursuing the most complex avenues of expression can suck the joy out of your vocation. Bringing it back around, I think it's Inarritu's Birdman is an example of this, a movie for someone who clearly hates making movies. I think the filmmaker loves cinema, but the message of that film is anti-cinema.
I think he hates certain kinds of cinema. I think that's probably mainstream pop cinema. Listen, I don't want to put words in their mouth. I never actually heard Inarritu say that.
Yeah.
But I can glean that from the work. Mm. The work suggests that.
Yes.
So that's the message he has conveyed, whether or not it's necessarily what he personally believes.
He didn't write it, too, did he? That was somebody else.
He might have, actually. Hold on, look at that.
Yeah, because there's like lines of dialogue that specifically downplay mainstream Hollywood cinema.
Yeah, you know, I'm gonna look that up. That's worth knowing.
And you know, I'm a Gen Xer. As anti-corporate as the next Gen Xer.
He wrote it.
He wrote it. All right.
Yeah. He co-wrote it.
All right.
With a lot of other people, to be fair, and it's based on a story by Raymond Carver, but he does have a writing credit.
All right.
Yeah.
I appreciate a film. Even though I was like kind of only warm on it when it first came out, Birdman, I started to realize how daring it was for the Academy to give so many accolades to this film that hates movies, says that theater is superior, and is slamming superhero cinema in particular at a time when it was riding highest.
By that point, it
felt a little bit subversive, intellectually at least, when you think about
it. I think at the time, Hollywood and the Academy, in particular, was still very much eschewing, honoring superhero movies. At that point, the only superhero movie that I can think of any kind that was ever nominated for Best Picture was Robin Hood, and that was in the 30s.
Yeah.
They were not... And one of the reasons why they expanded the Best Picture category in 2009 was because everyone was really furious that The Dark Knight didn't get nominated, because they thought even though it was a superhero movie, it was kind of a shoo-in. Nope. And a few entered in since. Joker got nominated, Black Panther got nominated. I think I'm forgetting one. But they were still like, maybe you can win sound design.
Visual effects, perhaps.
Yeah. No, but they were very, very much trying to like... not claim that as Hollywood at its best. They've since softened a bit, but yeah.
And third and lastly, I want to state my case on why I think you're off on your interpretation of Fury Road's main characters.
Okay.
And give you an opportunity to restate your case. I've heard you both repeatedly maintain that Furiosa is the one with the character arc while Max is the plot device, and it seems to me like it's the exact opposite. And I don't really see where the text of the film supports any real character arc for Furiosa, but not saying that this is a bad thing. She's obviously very important to the film. I can no longer dance around saying she drives the plot forward. So there that is. But I don't think that she ends the film as a different character than she started. She starts out the film thinking it's wrong for the Immortan Joe to enslave women, and that the patriarchal structure of the Citadel is destructive and must end. And that's where she is when the credits roll. She's the character who wants the thing and gets the thing. It's a great way to handle a dual protagonist, where one character has a goal while the other character goes through a meaningful arc. This is also done with Wonder Woman, this Steve Trevor being the force behind the plot, and Diana going through the significant change. For Max, he starts out the movie literally saying that his only instinct is to survive, and he actively refuses every opportunity to get close or to trust anyone because of people in his past who died around him, and after being foiled by Furiosa and the others, he finally lets go of his past memories and rejoins a righteous cause, culminating in making himself truly vulnerable in his own way by telling Furiosa his name. It may not seem like much on paper, but we do understand that it's a big deal to him. I know that Furiosa has one moment in the film where she says she wants redemption, but it's unclear for what, and achieving that redemption can really just be seen as part of the goal she achieves. So without further ado, please state your case as to what I'm missing with Furiosa's character arc, but please do sincerely consider my analysis. Thank you both, and I wish you all the best, James.
Anyone who gives us thoughtful analysis, and I don't mean just an opinion, I like that you didn't. Anyone who puts in the effort, someone did that with Predator Killer of Killers earlier, with Top Gun.
I was talking very wise.
Yeah, like, I will always take that seriously, and I will always consider it. I won't always necessarily agree, but I will always consider it.
And if I disagree, you know, I'm an asshole, I'll butt heads with you.
I'm not an asshole. I respect you enough to disagree and treat you as a peer.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it boils down to. Some people find that argumentative, like, why are you arguing with someone? Like, no, I'm treating you as an equal here. I would say this to any other film critic. I disagree, but let's talk about it. Okay, so get back on point. Mad Max Fury Road. Your case is stated. I agree with your point that Max has a bit of an arc. I think it is a very straightforward arc in a lot of ways, but I see your point.
Yeah, well,
perhaps we're understating Max's personal journey, I think his personal journey is more rote than Furiosa's.
It's more rote. It's something you see in a lot of action heroes. They soften a little bit by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
They don't turn into a new person,
but
they soften a little bit. They understand a little bit. And that happens in all of the Mad Max movies, where he starts out...
Mad Max 1, he darkens. Mad Max 1 is about him hardening.
Okay, fair, to be fair, that's the one I haven't seen.
Yeah, Mad Max is about him becoming Mad Max. The rest of them are about him kind of finding his way back to humanity again.
Yeah, but there's a moment in Mad Max 2 where he's about to wash his hands of... there's a village that's about to be raided. The people inside are going to be killed. And he's driving away. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where he has this kind of reckoning where he's like, I better turn around and help.
Yeah.
That's the moment where he kind of softens. That's his change.
That's his moment.
It's not a lot. That's what we get from an action hero like Mad Max.
Yeah. In the screenwriting class, they called that the indifference to concern plot.
There you go.
You start out indifferent, afterwards you're concerned.
Is he a big softy and a hero after that? No, he's still the same jerkish, taciturn anti-hero that he always was, but he's slightly softer.
Yeah.
And I guess we could say that's also what happens in Fury Road.
For Max.
He starts very taciturn. He ends a hair less taciturn.
Yeah.
It's not a huge arc, but there is an arc.
Your point is made. Mm. As for Furiosa herself, I think when you describe what she goes through, I think you're leaving some stuff out. She is opposed to a Morton Joe.
Mm.
Yes. But what does she want? She wants to flee. She wants to rescue these women who have been held in captivity and subjected to God knows what horrors. And she wants
I was going to mention this.
Yeah. And she wants to take them to basically Eden, the green place.
Mm-hmm.
This is a place where people live in harmony. Her dream is to escape the horrors of a Morton Joe and fascism and the post-apocalypse.
And we see some of that in the prequel film.
Yes, we see like what she was trying to get back to, and I think it's very significant. But in Fury Road specifically, she risks everything to achieve this goal, what she thinks she wants. And what she wants is to escape. And then she goes and she realizes that place doesn't exist anymore.
Mm.
Her entire reason for being is shattered. And now she has to find a new one. And the new one, ironically, is going right back to where she started, and not just opposing it, taking it over. We're going to tear down this system, and I'm going to be on top of it. Instead of wanting to flee something and evade the responsibility of fixing it, I will take that responsibility and fix it.
Mm.
So I think that's a bit more of an arc than you're giving a little bit of credit for. Does she always oppose Morton Joe? Yes. But the question is, how do you respond? I think it is a very natural human response when faced with adversity to want to run away. Who wouldn't? Adversity sucks.
And I want to state that that might be a bit of a difficult arc to read with Furiosa because she's so strong and resolute at the start of the movie.
Sure.
She's actually strong and resolute throughout. That's the nature of her character.
Right.
She's fleeing, but she's not fleeing out of fear or cowardice.
No. That's her solution.
Yeah, her solution is actually very very clever and is kind of undercutting the authority of this dastardly character.
Yeah, unlike Max, she isn't going from indifference to concern. Yeah. She's always concerned.
Yeah.
But she realizes that the solution to her problems is very different. And she has that moment where she breaks down when she finds out that all of her dreams were for nothing.
Yeah, there's that shot you see on the poster where she's crying in the desert. Yeah.
In a movie full of amazing photography, probably the most famous shot is her emotional breakdown. And I think that says something, doesn't it? So that's my counter-argument, is that Furiosa is on a very different type of journey than a lot of action heroes that we're used to because it is not an indifference to concern thing. It's not Logan. She's doing something a little bit more interesting and complicated than that.
Yeah. So that's it?
Yeah, that's one.
I was going to say the same thing.
Okay.
Ditto.
Well, thanks. all right. That's it for We've Got Mail. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for writing in. Again, we're sorry we didn't get to our P.O. Box. The post office has something to answer for. But we'll take care of
it. The post office hosed us a bit. Not anything to write letters about.
I want to make it clear, I actually support the post office. I think they're getting a bum rap all the time, and they actually deserve more support and funding. There was just a bit of a snafu. So we will take care of that on the next episode. If there are any letters in our P.O. box, we will read them, and we will read them first. Once again, Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send us that physical letter, a postcard, whatever you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes, and of course, you can always email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We're also on social media. We're at Critic Acclaim, which we mostly just, sometimes post updates. But if you really want to follow our train of thought, you can follow me at William DeBiani on Blue Sky. And sometimes I post pictures on Instagram. Whitney?
At Whitney Seibold, same. Blue Sky, Instagram. That's where I am.
And of course, if you really want a lot more Critically Acclaimed stuff, head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Even if you sign up for free, we have a weekly newsletter with material, with links to all of our work that we might otherwise miss, but also original material every week, personal essays, stuff that we're watching, experiencing, art that we don't necessarily have another outlet for. We do that every single week for free. And then for $1 a month, you get access to a lot of our exclusive shows. You also get all of our shows ad-free, sometimes early. We also have different tiers where you get different levels of podcasts, including our Star Trek podcast, All Our Yesterdays, where we review every single Star Trek ever, and the back catalog for that is over 200 episodes long. So a plethora of Star Trek related materials.
So much critical analysis
of Star Trek. I don't know how we've done it yet. We still have a long way to go.
It's been a long road getting from there to here.
But thank you to all of our patrons. Without you, we couldn't do this. We're incredibly grateful to you. If you can support us, that'd be great. If you can't financially support us, again, you can sign up for free. That's nice. You can also leave a review wherever you find us. That helps a lot. It would be lovely to get an influx of some new reviews. That would really help the show a lot. But really, just tell a friend. Whatever. That'd be fine, too. But in any case, thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful rest of your week. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.